Hey, Dad, how's it going?
I'm just in Richmond Park with the family for Easter.
I'm enjoying a family picnic in southwest London, where I grew up. We're having a kickabout, and my dad's just called.
Yeah, Mum and Claire and Ellie.
But his history involves settings very different from where I'm relaxing right now.
How's India, okay?
In a journey that spans thousands of miles and over half a century. My grandfather was raised in rural northern India. My father's formative years were spent in urban Kenya. So ours is a story of three continents in three generations. And we're not the only ones who followed this remarkable path. In 1896, over 32,000 indentured labourers from India were sent by the British to build the railway from Mombasa on Kenya's coast to Lake Victoria in Uganda. My grandfather was one of those who followed in their footsteps, attracted by better opportunities, and in his case, a pretty bride, my grandmother, who he'd only seen in a photo before arriving in Nairobi. Years later, in the 60s and 70s, facing discrimination in a new independent Kenya, thousands like my grandparents and father made their way to Britain to settle here and start from scratch again. I'm Neil Canwell, and I'm a radio producer. In this programme, I want to learn more about my father's family and the other Kenyan Asians who've made this incredible journey. There's lots of question marks, and I'm often relying on vague memories affected by the passage of time. So I began by travelling to Kenya. As you can probably tell, I'm on the train which still runs on the very same tracks laid by that first wave of immigrant labourers from India. The train is separated into three classes. The compartment I'm in is made of wooden panels and metal framing. There's a bunk bed, a wardrobe, a small sink. It's quite comfortable. I can see tourists looking out the windows, and there's a general sense of excitement as we begin our journey to Nairobi. Tell me, are you enjoying the journey?
Oh yes, I am. It's cool, calm, relaxing, and like hustle and bustle of Nairobi and Mombasa.
And what do you know about the construction of this railway line?
Okay, I know it was built mainly through the labor of people from India, and I think they came in the 1800s to construct this railway line. And I think actually it is the main reason, I think, that Indians made their way to this part of the world.
Over the decades, the settlers built a rich and diverse community. My own father has always told me how his generation had an idyllic childhood in Kenya. Kamlesh Purohit and Sabiha Koka share similar memories.
How relaxed everything was. We kind of felt a sense of freedom, and it was a very happy childhood.
Always buzzing, always full of street food, especially Mombasa food because of the coconut element and everything.
We used to play cricket on the streets, a little game called Gully Danda.
And the bustling market, the fruit market, the smelly fish market, the colours, still the street food hawkers. You can buy one samosa or you can buy fruit salad.
But the one thing I remember was how close all the communities were. So, you know, we had a few Muslim neighbours, we had a lot of Sikh neighbours, and we had a lot of Hindu Gujarati neighbours.
But much of the memories of people like Kamlesh and Sabiha have unfortunately been lost in accepted national histories. As Professor Hajbert Onk told me when I met him at Erasmus University in Rotterdam.
Asians in East Africa are not a part of Indian national history, African national history, and it's also not a part of the British imperial history because they were seen as just middlemen. You know, there was no interest to write about this small minority, which is really sad. In the end, Indians were more important actually than the Europeans in terms of numbers, in terms of money involved, in terms of physical contribution, building a railway and all that. Of course, the whole organization and the power was within the British Empire. But the people who were really managing and running the show there were South Asians.
But what about the relationship between the Asian settlers and the colonized African majority?
They had a common cause. They were both oppressed by colonialism, to a different degree, of course. The African was much more oppressed than the Asian, okay? But both were.
In Nairobi, I met author and activist Serena Patel, who has written biographies on influential South Asian settlers in Kenya and edits a magazine dedicated to the community.
People from India who came at that time, they had been promised that they were British subjects equal to all British. So they came to East Africa believing or thinking that they would have much more equality here than they were being given in India itself. For a while, it was so, because the British colonial officers who had come from India and were trying to run this country needed the assistance of the Indian.
What role exactly did our ancestors play in the economic transformation of the region?
I think that the establishment of the Dukas, and it is these shops who made it possible for the Europeans to settle in the highlands and elsewhere and get their daily needs.
Professor Yash Guy's father ran a dukkha, or a shop, in a town called Ruru.
I grew up feeling I was inferior to white people. And I don't know what Africans felt, but they might have felt they were inferior to both the other groups. Growing up very much in an Asian community, in hospitals, schools, where you lived, were all very much racially based. But, you know, as kids, we didn't think of it, and the injustices. We were relatively privileged compared to Africans. Not many of us empathize with them. The house where you are interviewing me was in an area which was restricted to Europeans only, and the dogs were trained here to bark at Africans and Asians. So when I was buying this house, I was in a real dilemma. How can I live in this area? I had built such hatred in relation to this area and people who lived there.
Zarina Patel.
Our house in Mombasa, there was only one other building next to us in that area, and that was the Loretta Convent School. Yet, I could not go to that school. It was for whites only. So I had to walk down, it was another 10-minute walk, to go to what was then called, oddly enough, the White Sisters Convent. And the White Sisters Convent was run for Asians only. No Africans and no whites. So I grew up very, very acutely aware of this discrimination.
Back in London, the British Library holds the records of the India Office.
Through these records, it's possible to see how the European view of Indian settlers in Kenya changed through this period. In a letter to the Colonial Office in 1911, the acting governor, Frederick Jackson, doesn't mince his words when he writes that the Indian cheats and swindles the Africans. He says, "Prostitution is fostered by the presence of the Indian. Every consideration of health makes it imperative that these people should be segregated."
In Kenya, I asked Serena what she made of these accusations.
I mean, you know, one example is that there was a plague outbreak. And the blame was that the Indians are so unhygienic. But the fact is that no services were provided. And so the unhygienic conditions were now being blamed on Indian culture.
In spite of the difficulties, the South Asian community grew stronger. Previously significant cultural and religious divisions began to fade as they adapted to their new surroundings. Professor Hajbert Onk.
What I saw, you know, they changed food habits, they changed religious habits, marriage patterns. For example, Hindus who started to eat meat and then eventually even started to eat red meat and even cow, beef. And I was discussing that with them and I asked, you know, pretty straight actually, you know, for your community cows are holy. So what is happening here? You are eating, you know, beef. And then they would say, you know, yes, yes, that's true. But African cows are not holy.
Well, my family certainly haven't had a problem loading the barbecue with meat. And someone who's very familiar with Kenyan Asian cuisine is Sabiha Koka.
All the Sikhs, the Hindus, the Muslims, we lived in the railway quarters, the government quarters, in and out of each other's house and trying all the food. So the Hindus would make the dal and the potato and the pure vegetarian, and we would make the food for their men because the women seldom ate meat, learning new dishes from each other. The sad part was we never assimilated much with the white population or with the black population per se.
This world would be very familiar to my great-grandfather. He came to Kenya from India in the 1920s, around 30 years before my grandfather made the same journey. In my hands, I'm holding my great-grandfather's application for British citizenship from 1954. It's on a bit of old paper here, and it says his name, his birth date, the 12th of May 1904. It says where he's from in India originally, Ludhiana district. And then here it says he lives in Nairobi, Eastleigh, Sector 1.
and that he's working for the East African Railways and Harbours. And then finally at the bottom here, there's a stamp dated 11th September 1954, and it says it's from the principal immigration officer in Nairobi. It's interesting that as a 50-year-old man, he wants to change nationality, having lived in the colony for almost 30 years. Maybe he'd sense that there was change on the horizon.
The garden party at Government House was an informal farewell to British rule in Kenya. At midnight, the Union Jack was lowered for the last time, and Kenya ceased to be a colony and became independent.
You're listening to Three Continents, Three Generations on the BBC World Service. We've just reached a crucial point in the story. In December 1963, Kenya gained independence from Great Britain. Bizarrely, there was a very British garden party at Government House, whilst across the country, millions celebrated.
You know, I remember at midnight, we were just literally dancing with joy in Tononoka Stadium in Mombasa. But then very soon after that, you know, there was an anti-Asian hysteria which set in.
If any Asian feels insecure, it is not so much because of what the government has done, but perhaps because of his inability to accept the realities of the new Kenya and to adapt himself to the situation.
At that time, for me personally, I really began to question that, who am I? What makes me a Kenyan? And what kind of a Kenyan am I? What right do I have to say I'm a Kenyan and demand equality as a Kenyan citizen?
I used to lobby, I used to write in the papers to Indians and say, this is your country, and show your loyalty to it, and become Kenyan, take Kenyan citizenship. Well, I mean, a lot did obviously become, but not that many. And of course, there were Africanization policies, and trade licenses were cancelled for Indians, and it was real hardship, there's no question of that.
President Kenyatta said he looked forward to the early Kenyanization of the commercial life of his country. Asian shopkeepers were left with little alternative but to wind up their businesses and seek new routes.
What do you remember about the crisis for Indians on independence in 1963?
So I think the Indians were very nervous, because if you were an aspiring African wanting to move up in life, in your economic situation, the immediate barrier was an Asian and not a European. But the Indians were so nervous as to what would happen that they wanted the security of a British passport.
This is a scene that's occurring almost every night at Nairobi Airport. Nearly 1,000 people a week, perhaps more than 1,000 a week, are now leaving Kenya for Britain. This is the Asian community, a community of which still about 125,000 people are entitled, as British citizens, to come to Britain.
For us, it was the ultimate destination, you know, coming home to the motherland. It was just, you know, the most exciting moment of our lives, really.
Sadly, my great-grandfather wasn't to make this journey, but my grandfather and his young family did, including my dad, who would have been just a teenager at the time. My great-uncle Raj Hunjan remembers his excitement before he packed his bags with a one-way ticket to London.
It was exciting in the sense, like, we were also into this pop groups and things like that, like Beatles and all these monkeys and animals. You say you want a revolution. Well, you know, we all want to change the world. And they were all from here, and we had some vision of seeing them. Tell me that it's evolution. Well, you know, we all want to change the world. It was quite nice that way, you know. And also, like, the other side is always greener. When we were in Kenya, we always thought, oh, Britain would be better, not realizing the problems we will face.
We are determined to preserve the British character of Britain. We welcome other races in reasonable numbers, but we have already admitted more than we can absorb.
The concerns of people like Duncan Sands MP, who you've just heard speaking, culminated in the 1968 Commonwealth Immigrants Act. The Act was designed to limit non-white immigration from the Commonwealth. It's a period that Lord Anthony Lester remembers well.
They used a trick, a device, from our nationality law to take away the right of entry of people like your parents. They did it by saying, unless you, your father or grandfather, had a passport that had been issued in London as opposed to Nairobi, you would lose your right to come in. On the face of it, that was not racist. It didn't say brown people keep out, but the effect of it was racist and the intention was racist.
The act has been described as a harsh race law.
What the government is doing is not morally right. It is a discriminatory action they are taking. It is racialist in its nature, and I think it should be condemned, and we are asking the Prime Minister to withdraw it.
It's not only racist, it was monstrous. And under any system which had a written constitution, it would be unconstitutional. Parliament misused its sovereign powers to take away from my fellow citizens what had then been their absolute right to enter and live in their only country of citizenship. It was done to stem coloured immigration, so it was racist, and it was completely unconscionable and deserved to be struck down in any country calling itself a rule of law country with respect for human rights.
They changed the rules, you know, so they, that will only take so many a year. There was a period of intense anti-Indian feeling, intense. And when I was changing planes in Heathrow, there were all these placards by British people saying, go home, you don't belong here. So I was really reduced to tears when I saw that.
The hardship imposed on the Kenyan Asians was extraordinary. They had no right to live anywhere. They had no right any longer to live in Kenya. They had lost their money, their jobs, their right to be there. They had been reviled by African politicians. They were, if you like, the Jews of Africa. And they were reviled for rather similar reasons. They were gifted, successful, and had become the merchant class.
Many found themselves essentially stateless and became known as human shuttlecocks as they desperately tried to gain legal entry into either country. Lord Leicester ended up representing a Kenyan Asian family before the European Commission of Human Rights in an attempt to expose the 1968 Act as racially motivated.
I began by representing them alone. Then I found myself representing all 200,000 in theory because there were a number of test cases. And the argument was quite simply that to subject citizens to less favourable treatment on racial grounds is inherently degrading.
As a result of the report, in 1974, Home Secretary Roy Jenkins raised the annual number of immigrants allowed into the UK, speeding up the immigration process for British citizens still in Kenya.
The British government was so embarrassed by the report that for years they refused to have it published. They didn't actually repeal the 1968 Act, which remained on the statute book. But what they did was to lift the voucher scheme in such a way that people got in practice quickly.
It is certainly not pleasant to make holders of British passports queue to get into this country. At Gatwick and Heathrow airports, capacity-packed plane after plane had arrived from East Africa.
The first thing that struck me was when we came off the plane and this cold wind hit us, you know, and you suddenly realise that, yes, you're in a different country. And even I remember the drive from Heathrow Airport coming into Leicester, you know, as you looked around, everything looked so clean, everything looked so immaculate. This is the England that I read about in the books, this fantasy world that we were going to move to.
I landed at Gatwick and saw men without shirts, all white men, digging streets, and I said, oh my God, look what happened to that manager, what's he doing there? All the time they were ruling Kenya, they were our governors kind of stuff, and my dad's boss's boss was white. So when we came here, we thought, this white man's below me because I'm not going to dig the streets of England, am I?
It was only when we started to encounter all the difficulties, things perhaps didn't appear to be as rosy as they were initially when we first arrived.
I remember we used to go to the newsagent shop when we were looking for some accommodation. Like, we would look at an advert in newsagent shop, a bedsitter available for £3.50 a week, And when we called on to the address, knocked the door, and they saw Asians, they always used to get a shock, and they said, no, the room is already gone. I precisely remember this happening many times to us.
Even going home from school was quite a daunting prospect, you know, to run the gauntlet. When you came out of the school gates, you just hoped that there weren't a gang of skinheads waiting for you, and all too often they were. And you were quite lucky. You regarded yourself quite lucky if you managed to get home without getting the odd slap or punch in the face or the odd kick on the backside.
In my memories of 40 years, I have not directly had any British person treat me badly or be bluntly racist. Yeah, you have the odd person in the street swearing, "Packy, go home," but you take that with a pinch of salt, you know. It's because they don't have the knowledge.
There was an incident where our maths teacher, who happened to be Asian, was beaten up in the corridor. So this is our teacher, and I remember very clearly because we were waiting outside our classroom for the register to be taken, and just as our form teacher arrived with the register, he was surrounded by six or seven of these lads. One of them walked up to him and punched him in the face. He was wearing glasses. His glasses went flying. He fell on the floor. But what I remember was the dignity that this man showed, because he stood up holding his glasses, holding his face, and just asked the lads involved to go to the headmaster's office. And it was very dignified and very controlled. And watching things like that gave us a lot of courage.
So the first job I went for after I qualified as a secretary, the guy was called Andrew. And he said to me, "What's your name?" So I said, "Sabiha." And he said, "Can you spell that for me?" I did. And he said, "Look, I can't spell it for you. I'm going to call you Sheila." So I said, "Fine, I'm going to call you Hamid, because it's the first name that came to my head." And he said, "All right, point taken. I can't spell it. Write it." So I wrote it 5-6 sheets of paper and put it on his desk. He never called me Sheila again. Like, my husband's called Barry to this day. My brother's called Fred. Because they came and they thought to fit in, if the guy, the white person you're going out with again to socialize, they're calling you Bobby because they can't be calling you Nadim. I'll accept it because I like the fact that we call Bobby. I've come from Kenya and now I've got a nice, smart British name. But to me, that was an insult. I've got a name. I like my name. You respect that.
And then I remember as a kid, I used to listen to Radio Leicester a lot when I was doing my studying. And I was at home one day and this English chap came on the phone-in programme on Radio Leicester. And he started to talk about this wonderful Asian family that had moved in next door. And he basically wanted to make an appeal for anybody who knew about a good book that would give them a good sort of understanding of Hindi and Gujarati so that he could communicate with his new neighbours. And it was only a couple of minutes later it started to dawn upon me that this was our next door neighbour talking about my family.
Hearing about the experiences of people like Kamlesh and my own family has really opened my eyes as to just what they went through. Here I've got a document that one of my uncles brought with him when he came here from Kenya. It's got a photo of a very 60s looking bus at the top of it, and it's a letter of recommendation from his employer. It's dated Nairobi, 27th of February, 1968. It says, he's worked with our firm for the last 5 years as a bus and lorry mechanic. He can do any sort of carpentry work also. I mean, it's a bit folded and tattered and it's clearly seen better days, but you can imagine just how important it must have been to him when he left for England.
You've got me at a good day because I'm frying mogo today, which is something that the Kenyan Asian will do. It grows quite a lot in Kenya. It's a root, it grows underground, it's kind of a yam as well. And I'm going to fry it and then I'm going to put a twist on it and garnish it with tamarind sauce and green chili paste and sliced coriander.
If I meet somebody who I know is of Kenyan origin, I will occasionally say jambo, namnagani or something like that, just because, you know, you have something in common. Mom would say, have you done the fungusa, which is basically, have you wiped the kitchen floor, you know, have you mopped the floor? And it was only when we started to realise that our vocabulary was very different was when my two oldest brothers got married, and they both got married to girls from India. And of course, when they arrived here and we were using some of these Swahili words, it was totally alien to them. And that's when you suddenly realized, actually, we're not speaking Gujarati, or we're not speaking the accepted language. So it's a totally foreign sort of amalgamation of a bit of African, a bit of English and a bit of Gujarati all kind of mixed in together.
So although the Kenyan African will not eat it with all the spices, for us it's the added value, as it were, to assimilate the two cooking structures. I hope you're hungry and you're going to join me in having some of this.
Oh, very hungry. I'm looking forward to this.
I asked Sabiha if, with hindsight, she harboured any regrets about leaving Kenya.
Looking back, I think it was a good move for us to move here. four generations of you born in Kenya, and I'm proud of that fact. Okay, the Africans don't class me as Kenyans, the white people don't class me as British. It's fine, everybody's got an opinion. When I have to write on a form, other, I can tick ethnicity, other, I'll put Kenyan Asian. I will never tick origin Pakistani because I am not.
Sabiha's comments about her identity raise an interesting question for me. My dad's family made this journey, but with a mother from these shores and having spent my whole life here, I've always felt very British. It's something I wanted to ask all the people I met, including my own great-uncle Raj Hunjan, who came here in 1969, aged 20.
I still would say I'm Indian, you know, because, okay, Kenya has been my home. I would never say I'm Kenyan or something that way, though I was born there. Deep down, you're Indian because that's what your region is, you know. My children, they see it very differently. They say, oh, we are British. They don't even put Asians, you know. For them, they haven't seen Kenya, they haven't seen India.
I feel British and I feel very proud when I say that. You know, I've been in this country for over 40 years now. This country's treated me very well. I'm also conscious of the fact I'm of Indian origin, but also that I was born in Kenya. And I think that's a wonderful, wonderful amalgamation of different backgrounds and experiences, that my Britishness is enriched by the fact that I have that sort of Indianness in me, but also all those experiences that I had as a child growing up in Kenya as well. If you take all those things and put them together, I feel very enriched as an individual because I've been able to really cherry-pick the best of all these three absolutely fantastic cultures.